Laboratory for Advanced Research on the Global Economy. Welcome to our event. Thank you for being here. The laboratory has been set up to create a dynamic space for research and discussion on the challenges posed by the complexities of the global economy and their implications for well-being. The lab includes work on business and human rights, with a particular emphasis on investment and the way that it impacts people's lives. That provides us the context for our discussion tonight. This event is kindly hosted by the lab and the law department, and I'd like to take the opportunity to thank Dr. Jan Kleinhasterkamp from the Department of Law for his invaluable support for the organization of this event. Before I introduce the speakers, I have just a little bit of housekeeping to do. First, we are in the new academic building. And before we arrived, I don't know how many of you were here, but we had a fire alarm. We were evacuated. If it happens again, which someone tells me that the probabilities are low, but if it happens again, we go out the door and we have to cross the street to the Lincoln Inn Field and stay in that corner there. So, and the stewards who are here will help us evacuate in the red shirts. The second point is for those who are using Twitter, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSC Human Rights. And then I would all just ask you to put your phones on silent. The evening's event is being recorded, and we hope that it will be available if there are no technical difficulties. As usual for these kinds of events, there'll be plenty of time for discussion. We want to have a lively discussion with you. I'll do a short introduction. We'll have the presentations with some questions from Dr. Kleinhasterkamp, and then we'll kick off a discussion. I am extremely pleased to welcome our fantastic speakers tonight. The question for the evening is, when can companies do business with the Israeli settlements in occupied Palestinian territory while respecting human rights? And to help us understand that question and think about it is Dr. Phyllis Starkey, who's an independent policy advisor and former member of parliament for the Labour Party. During her time in parliament, she maintained a strong interest in Palestine and the Middle East, chairing the all-party parliamentary Palestine group and visiting the region many times. We also have Peter Frankenthal from Amnesty International UK, who's the Economic Relations Program Director. He sits on the board of the Corporate Responsibility Coalition of NGOs, which is called CORE. He joined Amnesty in 1998 after years as a business analyst in the private sector. And his work with Amnesty has pioneered the organization's approach to considering the responsibility of the private sector to respect human rights. We also have with us Peter Webster, who's the CEO of the IRIS Foundation. He's led IRIS, the research agency providing environmental, social, and governance research to investors since the foundation began in 1983. His work has focused on the challenges of providing environmental, social, and governance ratings and research to a wide range of owners and managers, and helping investors make good use of that research and advancing the concept of responsible investment. And then last but not least, we have Dr. Jan Kleinhasterkamp, who's an associate professor at the LSE, where he teaches international arbitration and international contracts. Jan's interests focuses on the legal and policy problems relating to the international dimension of trade and investment and its impact on development. So what I would like to do right now is take just a minute to make sure that everyone can get the most out of tonight. So what I want to do is just take 2 minutes to give you a little bit of background on business and human rights and the global framework that you will hear about tonight called the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights. Has anyone heard of that in the room? Okay, some of you. Great, wonderful. Okay, I want to give you a 2-second a list of the things that you need to know about the UN Guiding Principles so that you can enjoy tonight to the fullest extent. The first thing you should know is that the UN Guiding Principles were unanimously endorsed by the UN Human Rights Council, and they set out what are the duties and responsibilities of states and companies with respect to human rights in the context of business activity. You should know that there are three pillars. You should know the first part is about the state duty to protect human rights. The second part is about the corporate responsibility to respect human rights. And then there's a third pillar on access to remedy. What you need to know for tonight's discussion on the state side is that there's a territorial part and there's an extraterritorial part. UNGP 1 is about states must protect against human rights abuses in their territory and our jurisdiction by third parties, including business enterprises. Now, the UNGPs also say that states should set out clearly the expectation that all business enterprises domiciled in their territory and or jurisdiction respect human rights throughout their operations. There are other parts also of the UNGPs that talk about extraterritorial issues. But you should know that the UNGPs do put that expectation on states to look outward. On the corporate responsibility to respect human rights, you should know that it's the global standard of conduct, expected conduct, for all business enterprises wherever they operate. It is the responsibility of business not to infringe on the rights of others and then to address those negative impacts that they are involved in. Very quickly, you should know that what did the UNGPs say that companies should have a policy commitment, they should do human rights due diligence, and they should be involved in remedy, generally. You're going to hear a lot about human rights due diligence tonight. I want you to know that there are just four pieces of it you should understand. First, it means the company needs to assess the actual and potential impacts that they might have on human rights. They have to integrate those findings and act on them. They have to track how their actions are responding to the actual and potential impacts, and then they have to communicate about how they're responding. Okay, and then a quick PS, you should know that the UNGPs do not contain any guidance in terms of no-go zones. So the UNGPs do not say there are certain situations where companies cannot operate. There's nothing like that in the UNGPs. What they do is they lay the weight of decisions on what companies do on human rights due diligence. So that's the focus, where companies are supposed to engage in human rights due diligence and then make their decisions. And finally, you should know that when the UNGPs applies to all companies, it also applies to investors, financiers, and others who may not be actually companies building buildings or doing other things, but it's the entire line of financing and investment that we're talking about. Even minority shareholders have duties for what the companies in which they invest in do. Okay, so without further ado, I'd like to turn over to Phyllis, Dr. Starkey, who will give us some political context and the public policy perspective.
I'll stand up because I always feel better when I'm standing up because I wave my arms around and it's dangerous to those sitting next to me if I sit still. Right. Okay, so I'm going to do the political context, and since we are still currently within the European Union, and I'm hoping we will at least on these matters stay forever in line with the European Union, I'm going to start on the question of why are settlements so important, and I'm going to quote the EU position statement on this because I think it's an extremely succinct analysis of why settlements are important. So the EU's view is that settlements are illegal under international law, constitute an obstacle to peace, and threaten to make the two-state solution impossible. So settlements are both wrong in themselves because they are illegal, but they are also wrong because of their consequences in foreclosing, I would say, not only the two-state solution, which the EU is still committed to, but any feasible political resolution of the context, because the territory is the territorial basis for Palestinians' self-determination. It's up to them to decide whether they want to give up and become part of Israel or whether they want to have a state of their own. It's not anybody else's decision. So that's why they're important, because they are illegal and because they frustrate a political solution to a problem which is right on Europe's doorstep. Okay, it's not on our part of Europe's doorstep, but it is at the other end of Europe, very close to a number of EU member states, and extremely important to the stability of the entire region. So I quoted the EU position on how they were illegal. Obviously, that has consequences for Israel. Israel is the occupying power. That gives them some rights, but it also gives them responsibilities. One of the responsibilities is that, except for very limited military reasons, they cannot use the land or resources of the OPT except for the benefit of the indigenous population. The indigenous population means the Palestinians. It doesn't mean any settlers who've been illegally settling there. The settling of Israeli citizens in the OPT, I imagine everybody knows OPT, yeah, because it takes ages to say it otherwise, is a war crime. And the use of Palestinian water, land, and other non-renewable resources for Israel's benefit or the benefit of Israeli citizens is defined as pillage. The occupation, like any occupation, is supposed to be temporary. The idea is that it's a guardianship to prepare the indigenous population for self-determination. Therefore, no permanent changes may be made, and the settlements are obviously a permanent change. Now, Israel obviously has an alternative view. It denies that international law and the Geneva Conventions apply, although nobody else accepts its arguments. And it treats the settlements as part of Israel, including applying Israeli law extraterritorially within the settlements, and including a lot of other ways as well. It exploits Palestinian land and resources for the benefit of the settlements, and it is effectively a creeping annexation. So that's why they're illegal. How do they block the political solution? Now, this map here is a series of maps of dates which chart the progress of the settlement project, if I can put it that way. It's obviously provided by Americans for Peace Now. And by settlement project, I'm talking not only about the settlements themselves, but all their underlying infrastructure, because that's an incredibly important part of the settlement project. It began after the 1967 war, when Israel occupied East Jerusalem, West Bank and Gaza, and its objective, pursued by successive Israeli governments or whatever party, is to prevent the emergence of a Palestinian state and to effectively annex the West Bank and its resources. And with the exception of Gaza, where the settlements were abandoned in 2005, you can see that the numbers of settlements over this period since 1970 up to 2016, which is the latest map here, the numbers of settlements have been increasing, and the numbers of people living in the settlements has been increasing, and it's accelerated in the last 5 years, and it's clearly now the government of Israel has become even more emboldened with the Trump administration's view of settlements, which is relaxing by the moment. There are now 600,000 settlers living in East Jerusalem or the West Bank. I calculate that that is about 9% of the total Israeli Jewish population. And obviously, it's only Israeli Jewish citizens who settle in the settlements. That's why it's okay to describe it that way. Although 20% of Israel's population are obviously of Palestinian origin. So, can we get on to the second question? Yeah. Right. Because this one, then, focuses down on the West Bank. And I know it's a complicated map, but what I want you to focus on are the key points about it, because this demonstrates that where the settlements are developed is not dictated by what would be good housing policy. It's dictated strategically in order to control the maximum amount of the West Bank, to basically control all the external borders of the West Bank, those with Israel itself, and this area here on the right, which is the Jordan Valley, which is the border with Jordan, and to concentrate the Palestinian population within these sort of beige-coloured areas, which is where most of them were living, but I mean to concentrate them more,
to have them administered by the Palestinian Authority, which kind of takes responsibility off the occupying power to provide for those individuals and effectively gives it to the international community, because it's you and I, as most of you look like you're European taxpayers, most of you will, like me, be actually subsidising the Palestinians, because our governments are providing most of the money that supports the Palestinian Authority, not the Israeli Authority, who, as the occupying power, should actually be providing for them. So, that's gone backwards again.
Sorry.
The blue areas are the settlements.
Yeah.
Then there are some little purple bits, which are called outposts. Those are communities set up by the more radical end of the settler movement, and those are developments that even the Israeli government says are illegal. So those are illegal under Israeli law, although obviously these settlements are not, the main ones are not. So the location is there to control the edges, in particular down here, the big blue ones in the Jordan Valley. Those don't have lots and lots of people living in them. They're, for the most part, agricultural settlements with a small number of people living in them, but they occupy a lot of land. Most of the residential settlements are over here, but then you have ones that jut right into the West Bank here by Jerusalem and up there, and they basically bisect, or trisect probably, the West Bank into different sections. And then you have the roads, which serve all these, which go along in these white bits. All the white bits are what's called Area C, which is under total Israeli military and civilian control. And that enables the Israeli authorities to basically control the Palestinian population, who are corralled within these different fragmented areas which are administered by the Palestinian Authority. In order to get from one bit to another, they have to go on the roads that go around here, which are controlled by the Australian authorities. And obviously, this is the wall, which would be legal if it went along the international boundary of Israel. But as you can see, it doesn't. It goes into the West Bank particularly in order to go round here and drag into the Israeli side of the wall a huge amount of West Bank territory, including arbitrarily extending Jerusalem, so it's now much bigger than it was, in order to take more land in. The other thing that you can't see on this map, but is that the settlements are on the whole built over the water aquifer. There's an extremely important set of aquifers in the West Bank. Those aquifers have been incorporated into the Israeli national water grid, and the water is serving Israel itself, as well as the settlements, and to a very much lesser extent, the Palestinians. There are modern roads and a light rail near Jerusalem, which are for the exclusive use of the settlers, and mean that if you are a settler living in one of these settlements along here, particularly around Jerusalem, it's not surprising that most of those settlers think they're living in Israel, because they live in a settlement, they don't interact with any Palestinians, and then they have a nice road or a rail that takes them in and out of Jerusalem and the rest of Israel in order to work in Israel, which is where most of them do work, and they don't see a Palestinian at all, because Palestinians are not allowed to use those settlement roads. The other point to make is that the land area of the settlements is often much larger than is required for the amount of housing within them, which means you sterilise even more land that the Palestinians can't get hold of, and you have ample room to expand the settlements without bothering to get any more land. All of this land has been illegally expropriated from Palestinians, either from individual Palestinian individuals or from what would effectively be the Palestinian state, if there was one. So anybody who's actually been to the West Bank can see the practical reality of what this means for the Israelis in the settlements and the Palestinians not in the settlements. It is a grossly unequal situation. So the settlements are subsidised by the Israeli government, so the housing is on the whole more affordable than housing being built within Israel itself, so it's not surprising that lots of Israelis who are not at all ideological buy houses in settlements because it's the only housing they can afford. They're well planned, they're provided with all modern facilities, including all the utilities that are required, like telecommunications, and, as I've said, plentiful water taken from the Palestinian aquifers. They've got these transport links, the roads that Palestinians can't use, and it's altogether quite a good quality of life for people living there. Now, in contrast to the Palestinians, and I have to slightly differentiate between the Palestinian communities that are living here in the areas controlled by the PA, which are largely urban areas. But then these areas are already fairly heavily developed, and in particular when you get somewhere like Bethlehem, here you can see it, that's unable to expand into what was land that belonged to people in Bethlehem here, because this has been taken by settlements. So they're very heavily constrained in their development space, so they get more and more overcrowded, and they're obviously dependent on services provided by the PA, which is perennially cash-strapped. Now, for those Palestinians who live in what's called Area C, that's the white bits, and Area C is where all the settlements are, they live under military law. They have no democratic rights whatsoever, because they're under Israeli military control, and every aspect of their lives is completely controlled by Israel and Israeli decisions. The planning system for the West Bank, which is an Israeli planning system, prioritises the needs of settlements, does not consider the needs of the Palestinians at all, and Palestinians are very rarely given permits to build new homes, new schools, or even to build wells to connect, if they're farmers, to connect to the water aquifer, and they're absolutely not given permits for deep wells. So the settlers have nice deep access to the aquifer, and the Palestinian farmers can only have shallow wells if they've got them already. And obviously that means, because the water is being overused, that many of the Palestinian wells run dry, and they can't dig any more. As I've said, for all Palestinians, the settler roads are forbidden. So they have to rely on the old road system, which kind of meanders around in between all this lot, and is controlled by the Israeli military with a network of permanent and flying checkpoints. So you can never predict how long it's going to take you as a Palestinian to get from A to B, because if it might be 2 hours yesterday, there might be some extra checkpoints or even a road totally closed off and it'll be 4 hours tomorrow. So obviously, this means that people risk being refused access to schools, work, health facilities, and it increases the cost of farmers and businesses transporting goods. The other point I want to make is about Palestinians working in Israel or the settlements. A small number do. They require permits from the military authorities. They're effectively a form of captive labour, because permits can be revoked and wages and conditions are poorer than Israelis. Collectively, the World Bank says that Israeli restrictions reduce the Palestinian economic GDP by a third. I'll briefly also point out that there is huge insecurity for all Palestinians. Without notice or consultation, the Israeli authorities can expropriate Palestinian land, demolish houses or farm buildings or even schools, and prevent access of farmers to crops. And it's very difficult for Palestinians to fight this. They have to do it through the Israeli courts, and they very rarely succeed. There's also military raids. There's no protection from harassment by violent settlers, and the military are there to protect the settlers from the Palestinians, not vice versa. The other point that I'd make is that here in the Jordan Valley, Palestinians have been almost pushed out completely from there. There are between 200 and 300 Palestinians left in Area C, because their farms are being taken and they can't gain access to water. So some of them do work in settlements because they have no other way of supplementing their income. I just want to feed into the contributions my colleagues are going to make, just make the point that in, I think it might be 2014 actually, the European Union issued advice to businesses warning them of the legal, financial and reputational risks of involvement with settlements, and the UK advice actually is pretty strong. And it's there on their website. I checked yesterday just in case they'd kind of resiled from it and dropped out. And businesses and investors are increasingly aware of the issue, not least because of the pressure from the public. But for a correct assessment of risk, the businesses need to understand the legal and physical reality of the OPT, because it's very difficult for people who have not been there to realise how dreadful the situation is. And they need to understand that and the effect that they have on the political and social rights of Palestinians. And those are the issues I think are going to be explored by the next two speakers.
General Journal to the General Assembly on the legal background, and it says that in its resolution 1789, the General Assembly reaffirmed the legality of the Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestine territory, including East Jerusalem and the occupied Syrian border, as ruled by the International Court of Justice and as reiterated by the Security Council and the High Commission for Human Rights. So from a legal perspective, there is very little argument other than denying the applicability of all this together. Those familiar with international law will know that Chapter 7 of the UN Charter does give power to the UN Security Council to actually care and take measures as regarding situations which threaten peace. And I think there is also a little discussion about this being, of course, the center of tension which radiates far beyond the region and is the cause of many problems in international law. So the rather unanimous position has usually been that this is something that the international community must care about, because it's not something that can be left basically outside the scope of the system of protection which the UN has established. I think that is all one can say at this point. So it's not the European Union taking a unilateral stand on this. This is basically when you read the reports which are regularly provided by the UN Secretary General to the General Assembly, you will find more details on why that is in violation of international law, but also especially including human rights. And in the latest report, which you will read about, is probably also by the UN High Commission on Human Rights to the General Assembly, there also is, of course, the emphasis on the role of business in all of this. To what degree is business obliged to take note of the legal situation, and to what degree does that impose obligations on the companies, on their home states, where they come from, as you heard earlier, from the UNGDP, and, of course, the host state, to what degree then to determine who is the host state in this. That is then de facto because of the government and our interest. But with that, I'll leave it to our other speakers to elaborate.
So now Peter Frankenthal will talk about Amnesty's position. We have getting here.
Good evening, everyone. The question that I'd like to address is, in the context that Phyllis has set out, what are the implications for business? What is a human rights compatible approach to operating in or doing business with the occupied, with the settlements in OPT? Is there a human rights compatible approach? And I think there are three interrelated considerations. The first is the status of the occupied territory under international law, which both Phyllis and Jan have covered. The second is the framework of human rights and humanitarian norms and other standards applicable to companies. And the third is the human rights situation on the ground and the ways in which companies contribute to this. And I think if companies were to triangulate these three elements, then they'd be able to come to a view as to whether they can do business in or with the settlements while respecting human rights. So let's look at some of these dimensions. The illegality of the settlements has been clearly affirmed by many Security Council resolutions, by the International Committee of the Red Cross, by the UN General Assembly, and by the International Court of Justice. So the logic of this illegality would be for states to actually prohibit companies domiciled within their jurisdiction from trading with or investing in the settlements. But states haven't taken this step yet, although there is legislation on this currently passing through Ireland's Parliament. It's the Control of Economic Activity in Occupied Territories Bill 2018. It's due to have another reading at the end of November. While states haven't prohibited such trade, many have issued warnings to business in the form of advisory notes, including 18 members of the European Union. And this is the UK's advisory note to business. The first part of it mirrors the EU note that Phyllis referred to, and the second part is the UK's addition to that note. And it represents a very, very clear warning to business. So what are the implications of this for companies with regard to the framework of standards applicable to them? The International Committee of the Red Cross has noted that humanitarian law standards also apply to business enterprises in situations of armed conflict, and that a situation of military occupation is considered to be a conflict, even if active hostilities may have ceased or occur sporadically. ICRC also notes that international humanitarian law provides some protection to business personnel and assets, but also imposes obligations on managers and staff not to breach international humanitarian law. And in the event that they do so, individual personnel and the enterprise are exposed to the risk of criminal or civil liability. The applicability of international humanitarian law standards to business is also acknowledged in the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights. These principles, Andrea has set out, provide the most authoritative statement of the human rights responsibilities of companies based on international human rights law. In June 2014, the UN Working Group on Business and Human Rights, which was set up by the Human Rights Council to advise governments and companies on the implementation of the guiding principles, they issued a statement setting out the implications in the context of Israeli settlements in OPT. And these are some of the key points raised in their statement. They said that the UNGPs, the guiding principles, are applicable in all operational contexts, including in situations of conflict. They explicitly recognise that conflict-affected areas present heightened risk of business involvement in human rights abuses, including gross human rights abuses, and contain specific provisions for preventing and addressing the human rights impacts of business operating in conflict-affected areas. And an area under occupation, they point out, falls within the term conflict-affected area in the UNGPs. The UN Working Group on Business and Human Rights were very clear that in situations of armed conflict, businesses should respect the standards of international humanitarian law. They're also clear about the heightened responsibility of companies operating in Israeli settlements, but they are much less clear about what this means in practice. So how do we interpret this statement of the UN Working Group that the illegal status of the settlement under international law and the information available in the public domain about human rights abuses related to the settlements should necessarily preface and inform any human rights due diligence exercise carried out by a business operating in the settlements? In what ways should the illegal status of the settlements inform a human rights due diligence process by companies? Surely the very fact that the settlements are illegal under international law means that companies should not be recognising and reinforcing an illegal situation, because in doing so, they're aiding and abetting an international crime. In this respect, a due diligence process could have a role to play, but only if it helps companies determine that the settlements are illegal, that they're inherently discriminatory and give rise to human rights violations, that business activities with or in these settlements help to normalise and legitimise an illegal situation and contribute to specific human rights violations, and that business activities contribute to the settlement economy and in doing so provide incentives for the maintenance, development and expansion of the settlements. Now, some of these points are self-evident and wouldn't require a company to go through a due diligence process. For example, that the settlements are illegal, that business activities with or in these settlements help to normalise and legitimise an illegal situation. But other elements may require a due diligence process in order for companies to understand better the human rights violations arising from the settlements. So just doing A very quick extraction from a number of UN documents and Amnesty's reports in recent years. These are just a selection of the human rights violations arising from the settlements. The other point that's not self-evident is how do businesses across sectors contribute to the human rights violations that are taking place? Are there some companies or some business sectors that could continue to do business with the settlements or invest in the settlements or trade with the settlements without contributing or being linked to human rights violations? And once again, taking from UN reports, also Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, and a number of other reports, these are a selection of sector-specific impacts relating to businesses operating in or with the settlements. I can't think of any sector of business which can operate in the settlements without contributing to the human rights violations that are taking place. If a due diligence process, and I want to go back to the due diligence slide, if a due diligence process doesn't yield these conclusions, and due diligence, as Andrea pointed out, is the key concept of the UN guiding principles, that companies should conduct due diligence, but if a due diligence process doesn't yield these conclusions, then it might well become a smokescreen to justify actions on the part of companies that are not in keeping with the standards that companies should adhere to. So although due diligence is an important element, it can only address certain issues. There's evidence that a growing number of companies are choosing to terminate operations in and with Israeli settlements in OPT. In addition, some banks and pension funds have taken steps to exclude companies from their investment portfolios owing to concerns about the legal and ethical implications of those companies' business activities there. The reasons for these divestments differ from case to case. In some cases, it's legal actions, others it's governmental pressure, or the outcome of dispute resolution processes under the OECD guidelines for multinational enterprises. G4S is the case in question, or it can be reputational risk, or civil society campaigns, or the ethical policies of state pension funds, such as the Norwegian government's pension fund, the Norwegian state pension fund. The legal risk to companies is a live issue. Corporate criminal liability for international crimes is an emerging norm. Depending on the facts of the situation, companies doing business with, in, or related to the settlements may lay themselves open to the criminal charge that they've been complicit in gross human rights abuses committed by other actors, such as security forces or other state agencies. For instance, between 2010 and 2013, the Dutch company Lima BV was the subject of an investigation by the Dutch public prosecutor following a complaint that it had been complicit in war crimes and crimes against humanity by virtue of its supply through its subsidiary of equipment which was used to construct a wall and illegal settlements in OPT. Businesses handling or trading in goods from conflict-affected areas need to be aware of two potential sources of legal risk. First, that the goods may have been produced in circumstances or settings that abuse people's rights. And secondly, that the very trade in those goods had contributed to the maintenance of an abusive regime. While merely offering employment to people in those areas might not be sufficient to establish corporate liability on the basis of complicity, some active involvement by the company in, for example, displacement of populations could amount to the criminal offence of aiding and abetting crimes under international humanitarian law. Similarly, while the mere fact of benefiting financially from business activities in a conflict-affected area may not be sufficient to establish liability on its own, the fact that the company has a financial interest in the continuation of an abusive state of affairs may supply evidence of the level of approval or incitement needed to establish accessory liability. Companies may be accused of being complicit in human rights abuses without actually being linked to specific atrocities. On occasion, commercial contracts for supply of goods and services can result in legal risk for companies, as is the case with two French technology companies, Amensis and Cosmos, which supplied surveillance technology to the Gaddafi regime in Libya, which was then used to repress opponents of the regime. Criminal investigations into those two companies are ongoing. In any such cases, the human rights context of the business activities will be a key factor in establishing any liability, as will be the knowledge and foreseeability of any violations that the company contributes to or that are linked to its activities. Given the extent to which human rights violations of Palestinians arising from the settlements have been documented by UN bodies and by human rights organisations, as have the contributions of different sectors of business to these violations, surely companies have no excuse for pleading ignorance. So what kind of model should be adopted by companies to arrive at a view that they shouldn't be doing business with the settlements, trading with the settlements, or investing in the settlements? And this is the triangulation model that I think would enable companies to come to the right conclusion. The apex is the status of the occupied territories under international law, and the two vertices, one is the framework of human rights and humanitarian standards applicable to companies, and the other are the human rights violations taking place on the ground and the company's contribution towards this. And I believe that if companies were to adopt an approach of this kind, whether or not we call it due diligence, then no company could reasonably come to the conclusion that it can do business with Israeli settlements in OPT while respecting human rights. Thank you.
Maybe just again a little word of contextualization. The exposure of companies to legal obligations relating to human rights is, of course, a subject which is in no way specific to that of the occupied territories we're talking about here. It is a long debate to what degree, not only potentially under international law, individuals can demand the respect of certain obligations from states, which is already novel under classic international law, which is only concerned from the outset of relations between states and states. But then also to the question, in which degree can individuals demand from other individuals, if we see companies and individuals, the compliance with human rights standards? That leads, of course, to a larger problem, which is to what degree can actually, on the one hand, there's a question, to what degree can these rights be created and then also be specified, because that is, of course, a major challenge. So far, the, of course, classical answer to that would be by treaties, because we see, for example, investment treaties. We talk about investments. Investment treaties protect companies against regulatory actions or regulatory changes of their host country. They would not have any specific remedies unless international created them, which means remedies other than those which are that of the host country itself, which of course for the foreigner is not usually very favorable. So treaties can create these obligations. They are created where there's an interest in creating them, which means we have to have states who actually enter into obligations with each other based on the conviction that that is mutually beneficial, which means this interest behind them must drive them towards the point of agreement. In human rights, that is more difficult. Let alone because the voice of those affected in their human rights usually cannot have the same power as the ones which have a more central interest, like typically in economic interests. Which means that codifying human rights has been one of the greatest challenges in international law, and giving them a remedy has been ever more difficult. And if we think about the remedies, because we are thinking about the exposure to legal risk beyond reputational risk, it is only in the last 20 years that basically lawyers have started to think about to what degree can the obligations of the home state impose something on the company. Because international law will not help us in that situation. So we need to find some anchor in national law so as to bring out a legal obligation that can be enforceable. And we need a court or a tribunal that will give effect to each one. And that is, I think, the basic dilemma we are facing in any of these situations. where local populations are affected by an international situation, which can be an international crisis, but it can also be just the effects of international globalization of the economy, to what degree do these people have rights to remedies and access to remedies? We tend to think about the situation of the claims brought by populations in Nigeria against Shell, for example. It is a typical example of an attempt to find some kind of forum and some kind of law which would give them the right. We could think about the situation in Burma, for example, where we have human rights violations which do somehow imply also economic activities, like, for example, the claims brought against Total owing to the activities in Burma, raise these questions. How can we find some kind of hook with which the law can help these local populations? If we now focus on this, the situation of the Palestine occupied territories, of course, the natural place to turn to would be Israeli law. And indeed, as we've already heard and is known, Palestinians have been, with the help, by the way, with a significant help of Israeli NGOs, been trying to get cases all the way to the Supreme Court in order to claim their rights of those affected by the government actions, but also then the related economic activities of the settlers and the daily life in the settlers. So, but that is exactly where international law tries to come in. If that national law is not sufficient to provide right remedies, where else can we look at? So these attempts to now look at the whole country and to say, we are sending out companies, or we're allowing companies to go to places which are problematic. To what degree are they bound to our standards? To what degree can we accept that companies listed on our stock exchanges comply, or basically do not comply with the ethical and human rights standards that we expect from them? So this search for legal hooks is really what keeps the lawyers busy, makes them extremely inventive, so far not really successful yet. By the way, I would like to also say is this is not, the legal problem is not specific to the situation. Every crisis scenario has its own specificities, but the problem, the legal problem is basically the same, and that applies to doing business in Iran. To what degree can you actually comply with human rights standards when doing business in Iran? Syria would of course be another thing that comes to mind, another place that comes to mind, Libya, but also the Congo, and many other places. Basically, any place where human rights abuses are present and do not find a remedy in local law.
Thanks, Jan. Now let's move to hear from Peter Webster about the work that the IRIS Foundation has been doing about investment in occupied territories. You've been doing some special research, and why don't you tell us about that?
It's all true. So perhaps I should just say a little bit about the history of IRIS as well, just seeing how broad the audience is. That, I mean, we were involved in doing research on company involvement in South Africa in the time of apartheid in the 1980s, and in creating retail ethical funds, which were funds for private savers who wanted to invest in companies they thought were doing the right thing and avoid companies they didn't want. But we then also became involved in helping pension funds in the 2000s, who were starting to look at these environmental, social, and governance issues, not so much from an ethical point of view, but in terms of long-term investment rather than short-term investments, and looking at things like unmanaged environmental risks that could suddenly blow up in their portfolio, or issues like inequality in society, which damages GDP, it is now realized, and which may therefore damage their portfolios in the long term. So a rather different starting point, but dealing with some of the same issues, and we've been involved in researching for all of those different constituencies. So just to say, I mean, the GPs themselves were a kind of coalition of businesses, governments, NGOs, human rights lawyers, all sorts of people arguing for many, many years and coming up with this formula that's been described to us. And Peter has been a huge advocate on the part of those human rights NGOs to try and make this as useful as possible. But it settles in a place that's got bits for everybody in that picture. So I may be going to get myself in some trouble with Peter by suggesting that my headline answer to the question, can companies do business in the occupied territories, in line with the GPs at least, is a rather definite don't know. So let me explain a little bit about how I get to that position. So there are clearly lots of things happening in these territories that are contrary to international law, and we've heard of many of them. There are lots of infringements of individual rights, and the whole point of the GPs is to protect people against infringements of human rights and to remove them or reduce them and remedy them when they occur. On the other hand, as we've heard, the GPs are also quite about process rather than outcome to some degree. So they don't have this list, as has been said, of places you shouldn't do business or circumstances where you should stop doing business. They are, though, very clear about the need to avoid doing harm or contributing to harm. So they say good things on both sides of this picture. And they're also very clear about what you should do if your activity is linked to other people who are doing harm. So they're not just fuzzy, but they're not a list of things you mustn't do. Let me just explain the project a little bit. So we were approached by the Open Society Foundation, who I see their president, George Soros, not president, founder, George Soros, was a student at this university. So they approached us saying, would we be interested in doing some work on putting the topic of occupation on the agenda for investors? And the way we approached this topic was to look at two occupations, Crimea on the one hand and Palestine on the other, deliberately chosen to be contrasting, and to have different opinions by other stakeholders about the two cases, so as to try and, you know, boil out the actual questions that arise from occupation rather than the questions that arise from the individual circumstances. So the initial idea was just to produce a reliable, accurate database of company activities, not as part of a divestment campaign or with any other particular objective, but simply to give accurate information to people to use as they wished. The problem then was, how do you get investors to pick up this issue and use the data? And as has been said, there are a number of investors who have adopted divestment strategies and done things on their own accounts. But there are another number of investors, and a bigger number, who run a mile from this topic for various reasons. So they can end up with huge political arguments internally about how they decide the matter. They can get worried about whether they're being asked to decide for or against Israel. They can be worried that this isn't the kind of general environmental or social issue they normally look at. All sorts of reasons, which may be reputable or not, is another debate, but this is the mess they get themselves into. So we've been trying to say, okay, how can we find a way of moving investors into the issue which they feel a bit safer with? And as has been mentioned, the OECD in 2017 actually came up with guidance for responsible business conduct by investors, which was very clear that portfolio investors do have responsibility for the actions of the companies they invest in. So there's a nice big hook, everyone signed up to it, all the people who are involved in responsible investment accept that this is something they must do. So our particular focus now is to see if we can persuade those investors that, as a minimum, companies who are involved in these territories must go through a proper due diligence process. We're not saying what the outcome of that should be. Peter obviously has a view of what the outcome should be, but we're just saying this is a process everyone's agreed you should do it. And in order to make that easier, we've come up with a guide which says, here are a whole list of rights which may well be being infringed in these territories. You need, as a company, to think whether you are infringing those rights. So all the investor has to do is to tell the company, we want you, on our behalf, to do that due diligence and talk to us about what you conclude. So as you've heard, the due diligence process has these three bits. First, you spot the risks. Then you try to make an action plan to see what you can do about those risks. And then you check that the action plan is working and that you are reducing the risks, and then you tell everybody what you're doing. So that's the pattern that our project fits into. The database itself, businessinoccupiedlands.org, has lists of companies operating in these two territories. The report we've produced has suggestions for the risks that you might look at. The thing it doesn't have, and in a way this is the core of the discussion tonight, is many good ideas about the action plans you could adopt that would actually get rid of the human rights abuses. And that's the core of the problem. If you could act in ways that got rid of those abuses, then actually the GPs would say you could operate in those territories. Peter's argument, in a sense, is there is no way that you could create an action plan that would offset the problems. But the GPs themselves, I say, they are on both sides of this, should you stay or should you go. So, for example, they talk about the clash between local law and international law, and they do say, in the rare circumstances where local law and other requirements put an enterprise at risk of being involved in gross human rights abuses such as international crimes, which we've heard this does, it should carefully consider whether and how it can continue to operate with integrity in such circumstances, while also being aware of the human rights impact that could result from terminating its activities. So as well as saying it may be impossible to operate with integrity, and you do have an obligation to think about that, it also says, think about the consequences for human rights of leaving as well, and put that all into your decision making. When you look at the whole of the package, there are a lot of things you have to do as a company if you're in these situations. You have to take expert advice. You have to consider whether to leave. You have to be actively pursuing the problems, each of them, day to day. You have to be communicating with everyone what you're doing about it. It is quite possible that doing all those things are not possible, or that they're anyway a huge drag on your operations, so you end up deciding to leave. That is certainly a possible outcome. But if you did come up with loads of good ideas, maybe it would be different. The only ones we've got from people so far in the discussions we've had around this report are things like, could you be engaging yourself with the security forces on the ground in the manner that the voluntary principles on security are used by mining companies to look at what they do in situations where they're working with violent or conflict situations? Could you get involved in peacemaking yourself in some way? Could there be sovereign wealth funds set up for the future of the territory, which companies contribute to while they're using facilities which are being controlled in the way that's described? So those are the kind of things people have come up with. How feasible they are, who's willing to try them, is the question. But in principle, there may be other innovative ways that companies can behave. Are there other ways to provide benefits to the protected population? Should there be adopting advocacy positions themselves on the underlying issues? That could result in them being thrown out anyway, but in principle, would that be something a company could consider? Should they be announcing a timetable that says, we will stay here for X time, but we want to see this progress on the underlying negotiations that would solve the problem? Could they set out what a peace dividend might look like if parties were to agree on how to solve the problem? In some conflict situations, that's been identified by players as a relevant consideration in reaching a solution to the problem. So, as I say, the action plan part of the guiding principles, I think, is the toughest bit for companies to find a good solution to, but I don't want to rule out the possibility that they can come up with things that we haven't yet seen that would actually be useful. Peter's also right to draw up the hard law point about international criminal liability. I mean, if someone knowingly does business in a manner that contributes substantially to the commission of a war crime, then in principle they can be pursued for international crimes. And the web of ways that might be done is ever expanding. States are, you know, agreeing extraterritorial jurisdictions, and the court itself is working hard. So there are very serious risks to companies who knowingly do these things as well. I would say the other general legal thing that we've spotted in this process is there is a hole in the business and human rights firmament, if you like. Companies have not adopted their own policies on international humanitarian law in general. So, you know, companies do adopt policies on women's rights, they do adopt policies on migrants, they do adopt policies on all sorts of... They take international treaties and they build them into their policies. But I haven't seen... I can't recall a case where I've seen somebody thinking through how a company should relate to international humanitarian law and set that out. If they were to do that, then the company would obviously have to compare what it found in the due diligence with its policy on international humanitarian law, and that might resolve the issue one way or the other for them. So despite my rather definite don't know, I think it's clear the GPs do require a lot of things. It's clear that investors have a responsibility to be engaged with these things, and we want as many investors as possible to engage in that dialogue. And in general, it's obviously very important to be finding ways to make these international principles much more effective on the ground. Decisions by investors and businesses are a very fruitful area for doing that. Plus, the new people trying to think of new ways of approaching this legally in third states, test cases, and so forth, is only all good to trying to find a way to make these extremely important international principles work more effectively on the ground. So there you have it.
Means then the question, of course, is also, well, beyond legal remedies, what are the more persuasive remedies, as one could call them, maybe? And in that respect, of course, focusing the attention on the investors themselves. becomes really interesting. And we had a really interesting event 1.5 years ago here at LSE about the commitment of the Dutch banking sector to respect human rights in their work when operating as a lender. And it was highly interesting because the representative of the Dutch banking industry basically started with a statement saying, like, why us, of all people? We are not the ones who are investing. We are definitely not in any place doing anything wrong. We are just moving numbers, basically, right? But they have come to the conclusion that everyone looks at them, and be that out of purely, let's say, prejudice that the banks must somehow always be in bed with the evil, or is it rather because basically they are the weakest spot? Because if you can put pressure on the banks and they change the lending practices, then you can influence investor decisions. And this is basically similar to what we've been now hearing here also is part of the efforts of creating a consciousness in the business community that this is not only about legal obligations, this is about how the public, and therefore we come to the essential point, how the consumer ultimately perceives these activities. And that is where the leverage lies, and where the efforts have been concentrating since. So introducing ways of having companies to actually have internal compliance programs and therefore engaging properly with due diligence becomes ever more important for them to be able to signal to the outside world, we're doing whatever we can. And of course, it is not only in regards to international humanitarian law, it is primarily being developed with all other sorts of human rights violations. If you just think of the Rana Plaza disaster in Bangladesh and many other places where companies realize we have to do something about this, otherwise we will lose market shares in this respect. But the hole that Peter has referred to is indeed in the field of international humanitarian law, this intersection of law of war, if you want so, and business conduct is not something which seems obvious, but as soon as you zoom in a little bit, it's unavoidable, which means this is something which now in business decisions has to be integrated and be taken care of in a much, much more careful way than it has been done in the past. To say we don't have anything to do with this directly will not longer be actually acceptable. So I guess it is at this front where the most traction can be found for actually bringing about some kind of change that can alleviate the situation of affected populations.
I mean, the question I have is, under the UN guiding principles, the last part about communicating what you're doing, I mean, it says the communication should be to those people impacted, but where you have very serious human rights violations, potentially, you should be communicating publicly. I mean, do you three, have you ever seen a company publish their own policy on business in occupied territories? Have you ever seen anyone, any company, publish anything in terms of their human rights due diligence assessment? I personally haven't, and I think it's highly unlikely because it's so sensitive. But I'm just wondering, you know, you would expect that those companies now doing business in the settlements under the UNGPs would be an obvious case for a publication of how are you avoiding being involved in human rights violations. Do you have any examples?
A couple of companies that have divested have put on their website the reason for the divestment is the illegality of the settlements. One was a Dutch company called Royal Haskoning, a consultancy firm. That were doing some work on the Kidron water treatment plant in Jerusalem, and they gave that as one of their reasons. I think another reason that companies don't is because their legal counsels will tell them that if they're operating in the territories and they publish their due diligence and they show therefore what they know about the context and the situation of their activities, that they are setting themselves up for liabilities down the line. And corporate crimes, complicity in corporate crimes, is an offence that can lead to prosecution, you know, decades down the road. I mean, this is not a company, but, yes, it is. It's BNP Paribas. They're currently being investigated in France for channeling funds to a Rwandan general that were used to purchase arms during the genocide in 1994. That's 24 years ago. The French authorities have decided to investigate. So activities that companies are conducting now that they may feel to be innocuous or that they can get away with today, a decade or two down the road, they might not be able to.
It should also be said that a lot of firms that have divested have not ever publicly stated why they have divested. In fact, they have often not even admitted they have divested. And it's obviously because it's just too difficult for them to explain why they did it.
So this is exactly what we hope will happen as a result of this work that we're doing, that we will get companies to find themselves required to make public what they have thought about and what they are doing. I mean, I do know of one, but I'm not sure. I need to check whether we're allowed to make it public yet. But we are asking companies to produce this stuff, and then we're going to put it on the website. And you're completely right that if they get the law wrong in the way they make those statements, they do expose themselves to risks. And some of them have made some decisions. They will do some things and they won't do others in pursuit of certain principles. And, of course, the activists, when they see the arguments the company put together, may well pillory them for the argument. That's all part of what happens if you're open about your process. But it's also exactly what the GPs requires of you. So if one can at least get that to happen, then all these other processes are unlocked. And we may get some good answers, who knows? And we may get some answers that are going to cause people trouble in the future. But that's the idea of the project, is to get those answers out there. So an answer that winds activists up a lot is, we employ Palestinians, therefore we are providing a benefit to the local population, therefore we're fine. And I think we need to be very clear that the GPs are saying, you have a series of obligations, and it's a general principle of human rights law that one doesn't count off against another. So, yes, if you employ people and you treat them well, that's good. It's much better than not employing people and not treating them well. But it doesn't take away from the discussion about land rights, the illegality of the settlements, all those other things, which you must also tackle in looking at the GPs and doing a due diligence process.
But also, if you are employing Palestinians, you need to take account of the fact that the conditions under which they will be employed are less than those in which Israelis would be employed, and in ways in which you as a company cannot mitigate. They pay into the Israeli system, but they get no benefits from it, unlike Israeli workers. It's not possible for the business to make any difference to that. It's not something they can mitigate. And then there's also the issues about the permits and all of the controls upon access. Again, completely out of the control of the business to mitigate those. So you could argue that even that supposed benefit in employing Palestinians is discriminatory, and you, the company, are involved in that discrimination, and you cannot get out of being discriminatory.
We're getting towards the end of our evening, so I'd like to open it up. If you could just say your name and your affiliation as you ask the question, please.
Hi, my name is Louise, no affiliation. I wondered if anyone knew anything about the UN database that's been set up that records businesses basically operating in the OBT, and if anyone had anything to comment about that, particularly how this fits into the kind of framework we've been discussing tonight, because from what I understand about it, it seems that it's the approach that's been taken is to record all businesses operating and to have that publicly available with whatever implications that might have, whereas obviously that's a potentially different inquiry to the kind of due diligence that's being asked of companies. Any comments?
I mean, I was going to say, so the database itself, I mean, our database looks at all the listed companies, so you don't need to wait for the UN one to appear. but it has been caught up in all sorts of controversy. It was not a universal decision, though. It was a clear decision to go ahead with it in the first place. And it's entangled in discussions which others may want to comment on about getting the thing out. But there's a group of NGOs who are pushing very hard on the Human Rights Council to get out the work that has been done, so that it can be used
in the way the Human Rights Council decided that it should be.
This meeting is built. This meeting, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yep.
This meeting is built on the premise that the settlements are illegal, that they're not illegal. If you look at any court decision, no proper court of law has ever said that the settlements are illegal. The International Court of Justice said in its judgment on the security fence in 2004 that the settlements were illegal. But the International Court of Justice, of course, is a creature of the United Nations. It isn't a proper court. And indeed, if you go back in history, go back to the time after the First World War, the Palestine mandate was given to the United Kingdom by the League of Nations, and the mandatory power had to encourage close settlement of Jewish people everywhere in the mandatory area, both West Bank and East Bank, although called East Bank became Jordan. And that's never been rescinded. And Article 80 of the UN Charter guarantees rights, and this was reiterated in the San Remo Treaty. So the principle of this meeting is not correct. And if you ask the UK Foreign Office, and I have done, why do you think the settlements are illegal, they won't give you a proper answer. They'll say, because our lawyers told us they're illegal. Okay? The United States does not consider them illegal. Now, I want to talk about some of the things that Phyllis Starkey said.
We need to go on because our meeting
Israel
is
does not control water, okay? That is a falsehood.
Excuse me. Can we need to go on to questions?
And really, you've been told a pack of lies. Please read for yourself. Don't believe the nonsense you've been told in this meeting.
Can I take another question? And questions, please, not statements.
Yes. I would like to ask you if it's if it's clear that human rights are being violated by the companies, and it's impossible for them not to know that they are violating human rights, why do they keep doing business with the settlements and Israel in general? Why?
Sorry, the answer is rather obvious, I think, because you make money. that is the primary reason why businesses engage in many areas, way beyond the one we're talking about today, all over the world. I think the more interesting question would be, what about those companies who take this seriously and then pull out of these areas and divest? To what degree can you actually have bring about change, because others will move in for the simple reason that they can make money there? An extreme example is maybe when all Western companies pulled out of the oil production in Sudan and China moved in and happily took over basically all of that production without changing really anything. That is, of course, a hazardous argument, because then, you know, you can say, well, we stay there because otherwise others will just take the business. But that is a very critical question. All around the world, how do we deal with these negative effects of global business? And as long as you don't answer that material interest, the law cannot really do much about that. I mean, also, when we're talking about publication of databases by the UN, the same process has been used in the Congo by the United, by the Security Council at the time, and it didn't lead anywhere really. So question how serious these matters are taken depends really on how much we are willing to confront that problem. People want to make money, they go there anyway, and they don't really care about the consequences, so it is about the consequences that we can think.
Oh, sorry, Peter, go ahead.
Just to add that the sands are shifting on many of these issues. For example, the UK in 2015 passed the Modern Slavery Act. One of the elements of that Modern Slavery Act require companies to set out what steps they're taking to avoid modern slavery in their global supply chains. So norms with regard to companies are actually changing. And going back to the question about the UN database, the origins of that was the Human Rights Council resolution that set up a UN independent fact-finding mission to the occupied territories. And the report of that fact-finding mission, the 2013 report, detailed the impacts of business across a number of sectors. And when the Human Rights Council saw the extent to to which businesses were involved in the human rights violations that were taking place in the settlements. At that point, they passed a resolution calling for the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights to develop this database. So I think we have to see this as a continuum. It's firing a warning shot across the bows of companies. It's making it very clear the view of the UN that companies shouldn't be conducting those activities in the settlements. And whenever the database is published, and although it's only going to include a relatively small number of companies because of the terms of reference, it's nevertheless, you know, one step in a much wider process of norms developing with regard to companies operating in particular in the settlements.
And just, in practice, this is, as Peter says, that people just thought running a business was simple. You just sold things to people and employed people and all the rest of it. And slowly people are realizing there's lots more things you have to take into account. So part of what's going on is just that businesses who've operated just on the basis of what they saw in front of them are being asked to confront wider norms. And I also think that I don't know of a conflict which is a peaceful matter. So there are always very strong different opinions, and you can find audiences all of one view or all of another view, or you can hear different voices. There are always very strong opinions associated with these challenges. And in a way, what the investors are trying to do is think, okay, how do we find some ground on which to stand? And where a lot of investors are going is international principles and international laws as a basis for basing everything. So every country that's involved in a conflict tends to have a difficulty with the international environment because it's not agreeing with them in some way. But that's kind of the way investors are going to try and find their way through this stuff.
Very helpful, Peter. So very last question, and then we've got to close. It was in the back.
Another report we worked on was links between French banks to Israeli banks, which operate in well-defined territories. And it's more difficult in that instance to kind of demand that French banks will completely cease all operations with Israeli banks or conduct business with them, because it also means that they have to stop conducting business with Israel proper and not only with the occupied territories. So how do we deal with these service providers, and specifically Israeli companies that work legally within not recognized Israel, but also reach out and have legitimate settlements? What are the suggestions?
Yeah. Right. Well, I'm afraid that we are out of time. Can we take one? Okay.
My name is Graham, I'm just a member of the public, and this is a very specific question for Peter. In 2016, at the end of it, Vigeo Eiris certified so-called green bonds that were fruit of Moroccan energy projects happening in the occupied territories of Western Sahara that held under military occupation. And then if you go to Vigeo Eiris' website, you will see the map of Western Sahara merged with Morocco, which no country in the world recognizes, including the UK or France, which is where Vigeo is from. But my question is sort of, how does a company that was founded on the principle of defending, you know, the respect for human rights and international law in countries goes, and after the merger with Bijou and France sort of turns around and aids and abets occupying powers in the name of green energy, helping the population. I think the question is great. Thank you.
It's absolutely true that Visuaris, which is not the Iris Foundation, let's be clear, if I put my Visuaris hat on, did certify these green bonds, but the process of certifying green bonds is about explaining to the market what the company is doing and whether it meets the criteria of the green bond standards. It isn't exploring a whole load of other issues at the same time. So Visuaris's explanation for those decisions was that they did indeed look at whether these projects were going to be for the benefit of the community in the area, in line with all these international principles. Visuaris does have an operation in Morocco, and it's partly, I mean, we have a lot of staff there, there's a big research team, and it's partly where I get my strong feeling that there will be different voices in any one of these conflicts. If you talk to Moroccan proper colleagues, they have a completely different view of that situation to Sahari people. So one of the challenges that a company faces in these situations is that their on-the-ground staff will have extremely strong views that may or may not accord with the principles that we're trying to talk about.
Inevitably, because they're employed by the occupying power, so they will hold those views because that's what the occupying power says, which is Morocco in this case.
Well, you can take the view that all Moroccans should be discounted because of the conflict if you want, but what I'm saying is that there will be very strong opinions and people who will give you all sorts of different histories and all the rest of it. The principles we have to work on have to somehow get above all of that, and Visuaris is very clear that the international principles apply, and it will continue to pursue those international principles even in situations where it's not easy to do that stuff. It may not be the answer you want to hear, but that's what we did in that situation.
So can I just respond to the question at the back there about banks and Israeli banks in particular? In a sense, the fact that the Israeli banks operate in settlements and in Israel itself, and that they cannot, if you invest money in them, they cannot assure you that your money is not being used to commit grave breaches of international law within settlements, that's their problem, not yours. Your problem is that you don't want your money, if you're an investor, to be invested in an illegal settlement. And you have to tell the banks that, and then the Israeli banks have to decide what they're going to do. They are